Good afternoon. I'm Lori Collins. I'm the marketing manager of the PKD Foundation, and we're glad that you're here. You are in the Welcome to Understanding Dialysis session. And if you're looking for emotional aspects of living with ADPKD for caregivers, it's in the Washington room right behind us. ARPKD, Pediatric Pre- and Post-Transplant Issues, is in the Lincoln Roosevelt room. And I've just got a couple announcements. Session evaluations, we want you to fill those out, please. And you can turn them in at either of the exits over there as you're leaving. And in case of emergency, contact the registration and the information desk. Our speaker for this session is Dr. Amy Williams. Dr. Williams is a consult, Division of Nephrology and Hypertension, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine, Associate Chair for Faculty Development in the Department of Medicine, and Associate Director of Dialysis, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, New York. I hope I got that right.
Minnesota.
And with no further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Williams.
Thank you. It is amazing how many visiting faculty members and patients go to the airport to go to Rochester, Minnesota, and end up in Rochester, New York. So that's just because of that. And actually, every time I check luggage, I look to make sure, does it say Minnesota versus New York? Well, it's a pleasure to be here and talk about one of my favorite subjects, and that is dialysis. It is incredibly important to start learning about all the options for dialysis way before someone is on dialysis. How many individuals in this room are on dialysis now? All right, a few. I hope this isn't too basic for you. It is so important to learn about dialysis because imagination is really worse than the real thing. It is a huge change in lifestyle for individuals when they go from not needing renal replacement to needing renal replacement. And the more they know about the different options, the more they can participate with their nephrologist in decision making to decide which option they want, because there's more than one. And I'm going to talk to you about that. There are also many new advances in dialysis that I hope will make you all feel better about just the idea of going on dialysis. First, I want to talk about who is on dialysis in the United States. Well, all ages are on dialysis. The typical ages are between 40 and 70 years old, but it spans generations. Individuals in the NICU, or the neonatal intensive care unit, are on dialysis. Individuals who are over 90 are on dialysis. So it's many generations on dialysis. What about races? All races. Blacks are overrepresented on dialysis, and it has to do with controlling blood pressure earlier on. But they are the one demographic race that is really, I feel, overrepresented on dialysis. So we need to make sure that we help them stay away from dialysis as long as possible. All socioeconomic backgrounds are on dialysis. One doesn't win out over another. They're all represented there. And in 2002, this is the latest data that we have, we should be getting 2003 soon, over 300,000 individuals in the United States are on dialysis. And in 2002, 9,000 individuals started dialysis. That's a lot of people ending with needing renal replacement, or over 99,000, excuse me, needing renal replacement. And this number grows more than 3% per year. So the dialysis units are just busting at the seams. There are so many individuals on dialysis. What are the causes of end-stage renal disease? I have broken this up into the two major categories of dialysis. The deep purple are the hemodialysis individuals, and the pinkish purple are the individuals who choose peritoneal dialysis. The number one cause of renal failure in the United States is hypertension. And you can see that 43% of individuals on hemodialysis are there because of hypertension. When you look at the other, and this is where the PKD individuals are, a higher percentage are choosing peritoneal dialysis than hemodialysis. And I believe that this is because they are educated earlier during their decline in renal function, and they choose peritoneal dialysis because they have received that dialysis education earlier and they want to dialyze at home. The second most common reason for individuals to be on dialysis is diabetes, and then come the glomerulonephritides. But even before that are the others, where the PKD individuals make up the majority of that population. Let's talk about the functions of the kidney, the functions of the kidney that dialysis has to do because the kidney can no longer do it. Dialysis itself does not affect kidney function if it's done correctly. It can increase the progression of kidney disease or accelerate the loss of kidney function if it's not done well. But it really doesn't help the kidneys come back. A big part of my practice is intensive care unit nephrology. And many times family members will ask, well, is this going to help the kidneys recover? No, it's like a prosthesis for the kidneys. So the first function is it maintains fluid balance. It balances chemicals and electrolytes like sodium, potassium, magnesium. It removes waste from typical metabolism. And it balances the acid-base balance in the body. It also produces hormones, renin or renin, which helps regulate blood pressure. And the higher the renin level, the higher the blood pressure. Also, it produces erythropoietin. And erythropoietin is what stimulates all of our bodies to make red blood cells and prevents us from becoming anemic. Back maybe 15 years ago or more, people on dialysis required blood transfusions. Now we give erythropoietin with dialysis. And we know that as individuals become anemic, as their renal function decreases, we need to start giving that erythropoietin earlier and earlier to prevent side effects, which I'll talk about later on. The kidneys also influence bone metabolism, a big influence of bone metabolism. They help with calcium and phosphorus balance, and the kidneys actually produce vitamin D. So it's the kidneys that are really regulating bone metabolism. And when kidney function starts to decrease, that's another thing we all have to look for to start treating bone disease early so that complications don't develop down the road. Now, what happens when your kidney function decreases? I talked about that a little bit, but what are the sorts of things that we as nephrologists are looking for and anybody who has a chronic kidney disease needs to be aware of? The first is fluid retention. So you see that by having some swelling or edema. Hypertension is another consequence of this fluid retention. And this can start to happen even before somebody has obvious edema, obvious swelling of their eyes or their legs toward the end of the day. Already, if the amount of fluid in the body is a little bit high, that will potentiate hypertension, so it will make any hypertension worse. This can lead to congestive heart failure, just from the fact that the blood pressure is too high and it wears the heart out, the heart becomes a big bag, but also if there's too much fluid there for that heart to keep up with and pump around, you can develop congestive heart failure. It also can potentiate cardiovascular disease, affecting circulation. So if somebody already has poor circulation, especially in their legs, this will make it worse. So it's very important to treat this. How do we treat hypertension? Well, the first thing, although I have it listed last, is sodium restriction. That's the number one treatment for fluid retention and high blood pressure. The next may be diuretics to decrease the amount of fluid in the body and decrease blood pressure. And other are the blood pressure medications. The big ones that we all use, and no matter what the underlying kidney disease is, it seems that ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers are the drugs of choice because through many different mechanisms, they protect the kidney. But by protecting or by decreasing the blood pressure, they also protect against cardiovascular side effects. The other are electrolyte disorders. An elevated potassium. Potassium comes from fruits, and tomatoes are a big one.
but this can cause funny heartbeats, arrhythmias, and sudden death, and often there is no warning. So depending on the reason of kidney disease, even before the kidney function gets down close to where someone is thinking about dialysis, the kidney might have trouble handling potassium. And this problem comes when the clearance is more in the 50 range, 50 mils per milliliter or 50%, let's say. The treatment is a low potassium diet. That means it's a bad diet when you think of a healthy diet, because it's what we consider a healthy diet, because these individuals need to avoid fresh fruit. They can't have watermelons. Strawberries can land them in the ICU. They can't have anything that has tomatoes in it, because tomatoes and strawberries and orange juice are the biggest sources of potassium and where people get into trouble if their kidneys can't handle potassium. We also use a compound or medication called K-exalate, and this is a resin that exchanges potassium for sodium in the body. The bad thing about this is you get rid of the potassium because you get a lot of diarrhea. So some people don't mind it if they're really constipated, but that's another treatment. A third treatment is to adjust medications, because those fantastic ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blocker medications that are wonderful at protecting our cardiovascular system and our renal function, they decrease the kidney's ability to handle potassium. So we often have to adjust those medications. Sometimes, depending on the individual, because those medications are so important to prevent the progression of renal disease and to control blood pressure, we add the K-exalate instead of decreasing the other medications, because when it all shakes out at the end, it's better for the individual. Other electrolyte disorders? Yes? That's phosphorus, and we'll get to that. Very important. For individuals with chronic kidney disease, this is just an aside based on that question, diet is just as important as any medication they take. And not adhering to the diet can get you into as much trouble as not taking your medication. Okay, back to electrolytes. But that's a very good question. Elevated magnesium. Now, magnesium isn't something we talk about an awful lot, but magnesium can get individuals into trouble. As magnesium increases, it affects almost every organ system in our body. And some of the symptoms that individuals will have as the magnesium goes up include nausea, flushing, headaches, drowsiness, eventually lethargy. And the treatment for this is to avoid magnesium-containing medications. We don't get loads of magnesium in our diet that we need to worry about. But there are many medications over the counter that people take that are stocked with magnesium. And what I tell my patients is just don't take any medications that begin with M. Mylanta, Milk of Magnesia, Maalox, they all have magnesium in them. And if you're unsure, ask the pharmacist. Let's see. Now, the next is the urea, or blood urea nitrogen, or the buildup of waste. This is how we measure that elusive uremic toxin, the one that causes all the symptoms of uremia that we're all so worried about. And those symptoms include fatigue, loss of appetite, nausea and vomiting, and the classic here is you get up in the morning and you throw up. You throw up when you smell food. Wave a hamburger or red meat in front of someone who's uremic nose and they'll vomit. That used to be the classic when we used to wait until someone's kidney function was really like below, way, way low before we started dialysis. Now we start dialysis a lot earlier so that people don't become as ill before they start. Bad breath. It's not unusual that patients will come in and say, you know, I'm feeling okay, but boy, I've got this horrible breath, and my spouse complains about it all the time. What can I do? There's nothing that we can really do other than to take, you know, breath fresheners, et cetera. Itching, easy bruising, GI bleeding. The blood just doesn't clot as well once these uremic toxins build up. restless legs. This is where when you sit for a long time or you go to bed at night, your legs just, they bother you. They don't stay still. They may jerk a lot at night. Some people can't even sleep with their spouses because their legs are so jerky. Muscle twitching or cramps. Sleep disorders. This is huge. Even individuals who have obstructive sleep apnea that we all hear so much about because of extra skin in their necks, etc., that will be worsened if somebody has, if they need dialysis or as they lose renal function. Sleeping patterns just get really messed up. Once they're well dialyzed, those sleeping patterns should go back to normal. Difficulty concentrating or remembering. What I hear is people say, you know, I used to read, but I don't read anymore. Or I have to read this paragraph 3 or 4 times before I go on to the next paragraph. This, to me, tells me that they should have started dialysis a while ago. We shouldn't be waiting until someone is that ill before we start some sort of renal replacement. Buildup of acid is another thing that happens as kidney function declines. Some symptoms here, changing in breathing patterns, breathing more deeply, breathing more quickly, fatigue, heart problems, the heart can't pump as well if our body is too acidic, bone disease, this is huge, especially in children who haven't finished growing, and the treatment is to give BACE. There's not a lot that can be done with the diet. We could cut down on protein, but the last thing we want is someone to end up on dialysis and be protein malnourished because their chances, their risk of death increases 25 times normal if they show up to dialysis and they're protein malnourished. Anemia. Symptoms of this, fatigue, shortness of breath, decreased exercise tolerance, heart problems, which include chest pain, heart failure, and then circulation problems. Again, if you have bad circulation in your legs, it's going to be worse if there aren't as many red blood cells around to carry oxygen in that blood, which is really what anemia is. How do we treat this? With iron. Most patients, because of their appetite changes as they approach the need for dialysis and lose kidney function, they need, and because of the diet that they're on as they lose kidney function, they become iron deficient. So the first thing is to get those iron stores up and then to add erythropoietin. Our target for hemoglobin or hematocrit, which is a measure of anemia, used to be a lot lower than it is now. Now we know that once kidney function is less than 40% of normal, our bodies cannot respond, or our kidneys cannot respond the way that, or adequately, to keep restoring red blood cells that are broken down. So as physicians, we need to look very closely and follow labs of individuals to see when their hemoglobin starts to drop, to start them on iron and erythropoietin early and not wait until they have these symptoms or become ill. Bone disease. Because kidney function decreases, the kidney cannot get rid of loads of phosphorus in our diet. The main source of phosphorus are dairy products, whole grain, nuts, potatoes, and also the kidneys, as I said before, they produce vitamin D, and as kidney function decreases, that vitamin D production decreases. If the acid builds up too much in the body, that also prevents vitamin D from it also decreases vitamin D production. So there's a lot of interplay here, and a lot of things affect other things. If there's decreased vitamin D production, that means there's decreased calcium absorption from the gut, which means that calcium levels will be low. Also, if someone is on a phosphorus-restricted diet, then that is basically a calcium-restricted diet because that's mainly dairy products. So another reason why serum calcium levels will be low. All of this causes our parathyroid glands, which are around our thyroid glands in our neck, to get really revved up. And they put out a lot of parathyroid hormone, which increases bone turnover in a very abnormal way and causes the classic bone disease of chronic kidney failure or chronic kidney disease. There are also theories that say that a high parathyroid hormone causes some of the symptoms that we refer to as the uremic symptoms as people lose more renal function. It just makes you feel rotten. It also makes you itch. How do we treat this? With a low phosphorus diet, meaning limiting dairy products, whole grain wheats, chocolate, can't have chocolate, and there's a lot of phosphorus in chocolate, and then giving the phosphate binders. And these are binders you take with your meals so that the phosphorus that's in your meals, another huge source of phosphorus is protein, which we don't want to restrict in individuals with chronic kidney disease. Notice I'm not saying kidney failure. I'm still talking chronic kidney disease here. But it all is even more important once they're on dialysis. But we don't want to limit that to protein. So individuals take phosphate binders with their meals, binds the phosphorus in the gut before it's absorbed into the system and starts stimulating the parathyroid glands. The problem is if you forget to take your phosphate binders, nothing works, and people develop secondary hyperparathyroidism. Now, let's go to dialysis. What are the goals with dialysis? The first goal is to remove all the toxins and to correct electrolyte abnormalities. Second is to remove any excess water or fluid. The other is to correct the alterations in the acid-base balance of the body. And the next is to accomplish all of these in a physiological way to avoid huge drops and changes in all of these concentrations and in the osmolality of the body if you remove a lot of fluid all at once. And the last is to do this, but minimally interfere with the individual's lives. We don't want their dialysis to be the focus of their life. Well, what are the options for renal replacement? Well, transplant, Fernando talked about that the last hour. I'm going to focus on dialysis. There are two main splits, types of dialysis. Peritoneal dialysis, which does not deal with blood and needles, and hemodialysis, which does deal with blood and needles. There are different types of peritoneal dialysis and two main types of hemodialysis, one you do at home and one you do in the in-center or at a dialysis center. And I'm going to go through all of these with you. For all the methods of dialysis, there are a few things in common. One, you need an access to get the bad stuff out of the body and give the good stuff to the body. Peritoneal dialysis, you don't need a blood access, but with hemodialysis, you need an access to the circulatory system. There needs to be a membrane, a semi-permeable membrane, across which things will flow based on concentration gradients. So if the uremic toxins are really high on the blood end, they will flow into the dialysis solution. But this is a semi-permeable membrane because we don't want protein to go out in the dialysis solution. We don't want the red blood cells or the white blood cells to go out. So it has to be a semi-permeable membrane. The other is you need the dialysate solution on the other side of the membrane from the blood with concentrations that will allow the diffusion of bad stuff out and good stuff in, like giving base, so that concentration on the base on the dialysate side or solution side is going to be higher than on the blood side because individuals need the base. And with every type of dialysis, the patient needs to be monitored. We need to monitor their electrolytes. We need to monitor their blood pressure. We need to monitor their nutrition and their overall well-being, which really is the bottom line here. This is an example of a semipermeable membrane, and here it is right here. This is the dialysate or the solution. Here is the blood. The concentration on this side of the dialysate of urea, which is that uremic toxin that we talk about, it's not on this side, so this will freely diffuse into the dialysate. Creatinine, which is another very poor marker for renal failure, will diffuse. And when we measure creatinine, it's because we know how to measure it. It's a surrogate for the other things that we don't know how to measure, but we know cause problems in individuals with chronic kidney disease and kidney failure. Potassium, which builds up in between dialysis sessions, will flow into the dialysate, and phosphorus that builds up will flow in. Bicarbonate, which we want the patient to get because they're more acidic, will go the other way. We'll give them that. And then the sodium is here, and we keep it at a level in the dialysate where we want it in the blood. So if you want your sodium to be 140, it's going to be 140 in the dialysate. So it equilibrates close to 140. Dextrose, which is a sugar compound, is used because we want that. It starts out, the dextrose is higher on the dialysate side. This causes increased osmolality on that side that pulls the fluid. So it pulls the fluid from the patient side to the dialysate side to get rid of that extra fluid. Now, let's think about what I just talked about, and we'll relate that to peritoneal dialysis. It removes excess fluid, chemicals, and waste. The membrane or filter is actually the peritoneal lining of the entire abdominal cavity, and I'll show you a picture of that. So everybody has their own filter in their body to do this dialysis. It is done at home, although some people do it in center or in the dialysis center, but this is a home modality. There is no need for a helper. An individual can easily do this themselves unless they are blind or unless they can't use they don't have good dexterity of their fingers. And when I show you the mechanism of how you do it, you'll understand why. There are exchanges that are done periodically during the day, or you hook yourself up to a machine at night that does all these exchanges for you. And the exchanges are actually the dialysis part of it. So this is a picture or a cartoon of an abdomen, and these are all the organs, the intestine, etc. This lining here is the peritoneal lining. This is the peritoneal catheter. The patient is here connected to do an exchange, but normally when the patient's walking around, this little bit of the catheter is immobilized on their abdomen or lower abdomen with a little fancy immobilizer that they have now that doesn't irritate the skin in most individuals. And the catheter comes in and coils actually down by the rectum. To give another view of this, here is the catheter entering the skin, and it's tunneled in the skin, and then it is in the peritoneal cavity, and here it's coiled, and all these black marks are the little holes where the fluid goes in and out. So this is what the catheter looks like. This is a transfer set to allow it to be longer so that you can see what you're doing and you don't have to bend way over to do it. Before someone gets a peritoneal dialysis catheter placed, first of all, we look and see, okay, where do you wear your pants? Usually it's not up near the waist, or when you sit down, where are their creases? Because we don't want it in those creases. Now, if any of you have any teenage children, you know that the pant line keeps going down further and further. So now we ask them to bring in your jeans. Where do you wear your jeans? Because body image for a young adult and for everybody is important. And for some more than others. And if we have a 20-year-old and they're very concerned about their body image, we want to make sure that they're compliant with their dialysis and do what they're supposed to do. So we will do everything we can to make this fit with their lifestyle. Now, what is the dialysis prescription? How does this work? The nephrologist prescribes the number of exchanges per 24 hours, and the exchanges are when you put the dialysis solution into the abdomen, and it dwells there for, could be overnight, could be for 2.5 hours, could be for 5 hours, depending on the prescription, and then you drain it out, and then you put in your next solution. So that would be the exchange. And then the doctor also prescribes the volume of fluid that goes into the abdomen. And everyone is built a little differently, so we try to tailor the volume that goes in to the abdomen depending on what what they can tolerate. I have taken care of many women who go through their entire pregnancy and stay on peritoneal dialysis because it's a very gentle dialysis, doesn't change big, there aren't big shifts in blood pressure when you're on it. So to make sure that baby's okay, we would rather do that. And even at 9 months of pregnancy, they can tolerate peritoneal dialysis very well. So if your abdomen is full, you can still do this. The individual selects the dialysate solution, depending on how much fluid they drank. If they drank a lot of fluid, went to a party, went to a reunion, drank a lot of fluid, they're going to use a dialysate solution that has a higher concentration of dextrose because that will remove more fluid. If they've been sick, if they've been vomiting or had gastroenteritis, a flu with diarrhea, or they've been outside working and they've been sweating a lot and they don't have a lot of extra fluid, they would use a lesser concentration of sugar solution or dextrose solution. So the patient really has some control and can say, oh man, I had that ham with all that salt and I drank all that water with it. I better use a higher concentration. What determines the prescription, the remaining kidney function? Somebody who has any residual kidney function at all needs a lot less dialysis than somebody who has no kidney function at all. Even if you have 6% of kidney function, in the dialysis world, that's a lot of kidney function. Also, the characteristics of that peritoneal membrane, that filter that the individual has, there are some filters that are very efficient and things cross very well. There are other peritoneal membranes that, for reasons, maybe the person had a lot of surgery in their life. Maybe they had radiation to their abdomen, and that membrane isn't as efficient. So their dialysis prescription is going to be different. And the individual's lifestyle. This is really a partnership when someone goes home on peritoneal dialysis. Every decision in prescription changes is made jointly with the physician, the nurse in charge of the program, and the patient. All right, let's talk about the different ways that you do peritoneal dialysis and what that means to your lifestyle during the day. For CAPD, these exchanges are done 4 or more times a day. They are spaced throughout the day, and again, the individual chooses the dialysate depending on what fluid removal they need. This is an example of someone doing peritoneal dialysis at work on their lunch break. And the first thing that this gentleman does is hook up to this bag that is filled with the new dialysis solution. And this is actually a Y connection. It's connected to that and to this empty bag. Once the gentleman has hooked up, he then drains the fluid that is in his abdomen left over from the last dialysis dwell. And then he fills from here into the abdomen. Really, there's very little discomfort at all. Occasionally, people will have some burning when they first start because of the pH differences between their body and that solution. But we can, very few people have that, but if they have that, we have ways that we can decrease that. So what is their schedule during the day? If this starts at 5 in the morning and it goes to 11 at night, and the green arrows are going to be when the person sits down and does those exchanges. Classically, they do it when they get up in the morning before breakfast. They do it over their noon hour or when it's convenient for them in the middle of the day. They do it before dinner or when they get home from work. And then they do it before they go to bed. Now, it depends on the person's lifestyle, whether that's the kind of prescription that they choose. Now, let's say that they're on this, they've chosen this, but they lose more kidney function, which is very typical. As time goes on, you continue to lose kidney function. And you need to change the prescription to keep up with that so the patient does not feel sick. Well, you can still do this around so they can have the lifestyle that they want. They can still do these first 3 exchanges the way they typically do, so they can go to school or go to work or do whatever they do during their day. But then they might do a shorter one in the evening at home that doesn't interfere with their lifestyle, just to get in a little bit more dialysis. Now I'm going to talk, yes? an exchange, the same question. Did you ask how long? It depends on the individual. Usually it takes, we hope it doesn't take more than 20, 25 minutes. Some people, though, because they're reading a book or they're talking to a friend, they will drain, and then they'll sit there reading their book for a half an hour, and they only need to sit there for 15 minutes at the most to drain. And if they sit there and they're draining for that long, that's that many half hours or 40 minutes during the day they don't get dialysis. So we want them to do it and to concentrate. I've had patients, we like them to do it in a room where they are not distracted, where they can keep a sterile area, because when they do that exchange, we don't want them to introduce infection. But I've had people do it in their combines, which I don't think is a good idea, but they do it in their combines. I've had people do it with their toddlers in the room, and we talk about strategies of, okay, how can we do this so you don't have your 2.5-year-old right there on top of you, because I'm worried about breaking sterile connections, et cetera, or just being distracted when they're doing this. I hope that answers your questions. Yeah. If they go a day without doing it, consequences can be great. It depends on their residual kidney function, how much native kidney function they have left. It also depends on what they eat. The biggest thing we worry about is potassium buildup and fluid buildup. I would never encourage anyone to go a day without it. I often have individuals or patients who do go a day or two without it, and they show up in the emergency room with a high potassium or in congestive heart failure. Those are the big concerns. If someone doesn't eat very much and doesn't drink very much, they can get away without doing their dialysis for a day. You can never make up the dialysis you miss. It takes such a toll on your body that even though, yeah, you can get those numbers to look okay in your lab numbers, you can never make up missed dialysis sessions. And as I go further in my talk, you'll see where I'm coming from there. I am someone who believes you can never get enough dialysis because our kidneys don't work intermittently normally. So why should we dialyze intermittently? Now I'm going to talk about automated peritoneal dialysis. And this is when these exchanges are done by a cycler at night while the individual sleeps. Just said that. And again, the individual chooses the solutions based on what they drank or ate that day, how much fluid do they need to remove. This is a picture of a cycler, and that's about the size of the cyclers. They're sort of like suitcases. And here, this bag in this picture should be bigger. Usually these are about 5-liter bags or more. The typical amount of fluid that goes in the abdomen is about 2 to 2.5 liters. At night, when they do these exchanges, we can do higher volumes because they're lying down and they don't feel that pressure and they're sleeping through all of it. Whereas during the day, when you use bigger volumes, sometimes you can feel that pressure. And when you're lying down and standing up, the pressure in the abdomen, even without peritoneal fluid in there, goes up 300%. So we don't want all that pressure in there. Yes?
Going on, if you're using this kind of dialysis, and you're going on vacation for 2 weeks, okay, you're taking a plane, you're going to rent a car seat. Could that, it's just like a suitcase.
Mm-hmm.
Do they let you bring it on?
You bet. This is yours at home. And you take it, and the company, the question was, I'm supposed to repeat them for the tape. If you go on vacation and you're on peritoneal dialysis, what do? If you're just going to go for a weekend, you take all your solution with you. If you're on a cycler, you take your cycler with you. If you're going someplace for a long period of time, even just 2 weeks, that's a lot of solute boxes of solution to take. You call the company in advance and ask them to do a drop-off where you're going. I have many patients who spend the summers in the South and the winters in Minnesota, and they just know, they let the company know a couple months in advance or a month in advance, I go down to Texas, can you deliver all of my stuff down there? And people, when they show up in the hospital, bring that cycler with them. If you don't want to take the cycler, you can always go to the CAPD that I talked about before, where you do the exchanges during the day. I think that you check it. I believe you check it. But it's, you take it on the plane with you? Okay, well, he knows.
I don't know about after September 11th. I didn't want to listen.
What do you do with the
cycler?
Finished bag? How do you dispose of?
You throw them away, or you'd empty them down the drain and throw the plastic away.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that it's not so easy. These are very practical questions. So this is somebody on a cycler. Then you usually call the, you disconnect usually. You'll know alarm will go off. Alarm will go off and it'll wake you up. Yep. And you disconnect. You call the nurse in the morning. Say, what do I do? Yes. There is a risk of infection. The risk of infection is much less than it was 10 years ago because of the different setups now and this Y connecting where it's all together as opposed to doing multiple connections. But the risk of infection is no greater than a risk of infection with hemodialysis and with access with that. It used to be one of the major contraindications to peritoneal dialysis. It's not anymore. As long as the individual who is doing the exchanges pays attention to what they're doing. The typical cause of infection is just breaking that sterile technique. During the training session for this, and it usually takes about a week to train for peritoneal dialysis, the nurses look at this very carefully. If the individual who is learning how to do it is not comfortable, or if the nurse is not comfortable, that training continues. All right. I may not be able to get through my talk, so maybe what we should do is wait until the end and write your questions down, okay? Now this is a typical day in someone who is on the cycler at night, and I'm starting at 5 p.m. and then 12 a.m., or that would be midnight, and then the rest of the day. Green arrows are the exchanges. Person goes to bed at 10, they hook themselves up to the machine. About 2.5 hours later, the machine does an exchange. About 2.5 hours later, the machine does an exchange. About 2.5 hours later, the machine does an exchange. Usually the last thing that the machine does is fill the abdomen. Now, usually, it depends on the individual. You can fill the abdomen with the same volume of fluid they had at night. Some people are dry during the day with no fluid, and that's part of the prescription that is individualized. Now, someone's on the cycler, but they're not getting enough dialysis. This was okay when they had 6% of kidney function, but now they have none. What do we do? Well, same thing, starting with 6 in the evening when they get home from work. They start when they go to bed, their first exchange. In the morning, and then every 2.5 hours, they do their exchanges. But then at noon, they do another exchange during the day. Patient says, you know, I don't want to do this. I'm at work. I don't want anyone to know I'm on dialysis because they'll think I'm sick and I don't feel sick. Okay, you don't have to do it at noon. The other thing that can happen is they do it at night. And again, same old thing. They disconnect from the machine in the morning. But then we add another short exchange before they go to bed at night. So they don't have to take all their supplies with them to work or to school. It can all be done at home. Now I'm going to switch over to hemodialysis. Hemodialysis, like peritoneal dialysis, removes all the excess fluid, chemicals, and waste. The filter is not part of the person anymore. It's part of the dialysis machine, per se, and it is chosen depending on the person's needs, how much dialysis the person actually needs. And this can be done at home or in the dialysis center. It can be done 3 to 6 to 7 times a week, and you may not need a helper to do hemodialysis. You don't always need a helper. That's a big message here. Okay, typical dialysis setup with an individual who has two needles in her access, and I'll talk about the access in detail. Blood comes out through the arterial line, goes through the dialyzer, and comes back to the body. Dialysis solution runs also through the dialyzer to have that exchange across the membrane. This is what a dialyzer looks like. The blood enters from the top and leaves from the bottom. The dialysate enters here and goes to the top. So they're running different ways. So that concentration gradient is always set up. It's never quite saturated. And that's very important to achieve adequate dialysis. If we do a cross-section of the dialysis filter, here are these hollow fibers that have the membrane around them and the blood inside. And the dialysate, or the solution, bathes these fibers that go through these tubes. And here's an example of what happens, the diffusion of chemicals. Inside the tubes where the blood is, that's where the blood cells are. They don't come out into the dialysate solution. Potassium is usually higher in the blood than it is in the dialysate solution, so that diffuses across until it gets to a level where we want it. Urea comes out, creatinine comes out, sodium equilibrates. So that's just a cartoon to give you an idea of what we're talking about. Now you need an access for dialysis. This is a temporary acute hemodialysis access that I hope no one in this room needs. These are individuals that show up and need dialysis right away, and you can't wait to get in a permanent access. These are individuals in the ICU, people who show up in the office who have significant uremic symptoms, or they're in congestive heart failure, or their potassium is too high, and they need to start urgently. These catheters are like large IVs with two ports. Instead of those two needles you saw in the arm, they have these two ports. And here are the holes at the bottom where the blood goes in and out. And they are either put in the jugular vein or the subclavian vein. Rarely the subclavian vein, because it causes too much trauma to that vein, which can then cause swelling in the arm. The problem with these is that they are very temporary. They suck up against the lining of the blood vessel, so you don't get good flows. They are very traumatic to the blood vessels, so the blood vessels can become scarred and stenotic or narrowed. And they are a setup for infection. It's a direct access into the bloodstream for bacteria. We try very hard to prevent that, but this is only used acutely. Some individuals cannot have a permanent access placed in the arm or the leg because of vascular abnormalities or severe vascular disease. Or they may only be on hemodialysis for a predictable short period of time. Those individuals have a tunneled catheter, and that's what this is, where this catheter, it enters the bloodstream in the same place in the jugular vein, but it's tunneled under the skin, and it has an internal cuff that guards against infection. Not perfect, still problems with stenosis or scarring of that vessel, so we try not to use these. You cannot get as efficient dialysis with these types of catheters as you can with a permanent access because of recirculation, where we end up dialyzing the same blood over and over again, so it's less efficient. Also, your blood flows cannot be as high, which is a more efficient way to dialyze. The ideal access is an AV fistula, and that's where a vein that has a very thin wall and the artery, which has a thick muscular wall, are sewn together. It can be here, it can be here, it can be in the thigh. And what happens is this high blood flow through the artery causes this vein to get stretched out and bigger, and that's where the needles go for dialysis. And it works very well. There's no foreign object there, infection rates are very, very rare. Clotting is very, very rare. Stenosis does occur, but we watch this carefully on hemodialysis, and we do monitoring with an ultrasound device, and when we see the flow rate go down, these people go and it gets dilated with a balloon. So we can keep that access working. If somebody cannot have an AV fistula because the surgeon feels that their veins are too thin or their arteries aren't as good, then they get a synthetic loop graft which ties that artery and the vein together, and it's big enough so that there's places to put two needles again for dialysis. It does the same thing. If I had to have an access, AV fistula number one, this number two, and if I really needed to, one of the other accesses. All right, typical dialysis setup. Do I only have 5 more minutes? Okay, all right, I'm sorry, I'm taking way too long. Typical dialysis setup. Conventional 3 times a week dialysis. What is the schedule? You either dialyze Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. You come to the dialysis center. You dialyze for 3.5 to 4.5 hours. The more we know about adequate dialysis, the more those hours increase or the time increases. And there is rapid removal of fluid and waste and rapid correction of electrolytes. What's the problem? And then you go home. What's the problem here? First of all, you have to come to the dialysis center. Disrupts your day. It's like having a part-time job. What can we do to correct that? There are many options for hemodialysis, home, daily, or frequent dialysis. Home nocturnal dialysis, where you do it at night, hemodialysis, when you sleep. Home conventional, 3 times a week dialysis. In-center daily or frequent dialysis, meaning more than 3 times a week, or in-center nocturnal where you dialyze all night long. Not many centers offer that. And then in-center conventional 3 times a week. There are 3 home modalities, much better for the individual. We know that individuals on home dialysis have improved nutrition, decreased number of hospitalizations, improved survival, increased independence, increased rehabilitation, and an overall improved sense of well-being. It's much better to be at home dialyzing. The other thing that's wrong with this conventional dialysis schedule is all the rapid stuff. No, you know, our kidneys don't do this rapidly and in an unphysiological way, but conventional dialysis does it in an unphysiological way. In fact, if you look at this, where the orange line is normal balance, fluid balance, electrolyte balance, right where you want to be. Each of these stars is where you actually do your dialysis. So fluid and electrolytes build up, acid builds up, you come to dialysis, boom, we knock it way down. We knock it down so it passes that normal line so that you can make it to the next dialysis. Because this is Monday, now you've got to wait until Wednesday, boom. Now you've got to wait until Friday, boom. And now you have the whole weekend. That's not very physiologic at all. We know that for those patients who dialyze 3 times a week, these rapid shifts in unphysiological way that we dialyze people causes cramping, headaches, nausea and vomiting, drops in blood pressure at the end of dialysis or in the middle of dialysis, and when they're done with dialysis, they feel absolutely washed out. It can also induce abnormal heart rhythms. So what we recommend is for people to dialyze more frequently than 3 times a week. And the more frequently you dialyze, the better you feel. And here I've just outlined these options. Daily dialysis is when someone dialyzes daily for short periods of time. It sure is easy if you're at home with your own machine. You do it when you feel, when you want to. Nocturnal dialysis, you hook yourself up to the machine and dialyze all night. The more frequently, if you dialyze frequently during the week, you don't need a helper because it's so gentle and it is so stable that, or, and that you are so stable during dialysis, there's nothing for that helper to do. Frequent dialysis, we know, improves blood pressure control. People need one-third the amount of blood pressure medications. It achieves a true dry weight where they don't have to pull so much weight on fluid on dialysis so that you can make it until the next dialysis session. You pull the amount of fluid that you drink every day. And on nocturnal dialysis, they may be pulling at the most 250 milliliters an hour. So it's not tough on your heart. It's not tough on your system. It decreases weight changes between dialysis sessions and during dialysis sessions because you don't need to remove as much fluid if you dialyze more frequently. It decreases the low blood pressure in the middle of dialysis and after dialysis because you had to remove more than a liter an hour on dialysis. And it decreases cramping, headache, shortness of breath. This is a chart that shows and I don't know if this came out in your syllabus, the three different types of dialysis, knowing it's a continuum from three times a week to six times a week, and the more frequently you dialyze, the better these things are. The typical time to dialyze three times a week is 3.5 to 4.5 hours. It's about 1 hour and 45 minutes to 2.5 hours if you dialyze six times a week. Nocturnal, it's 6 to 8 hours, depending on how long you sleep at night. With the alarms going off because blood pressure is too low, because the patient is not tolerating the fluid removal, pulse is too high. With conventional dialysis, it happens, and I'll show you a graph of the difference. Rarely happens on six times a week, and basically never happens on nocturnal. Blood pressure control, you still have the real high blood pressure before dialysis because of fluid accumulation, and then low blood pressure after dialysis with three times a week. That is eliminated with six times a week, much better blood pressure control. With nocturnal, much, much better blood pressure control, to the point where we think long-term studies here will show that cardiovascular disease in these individuals is significantly decreased. Fluid and electrolyte shifts decrease the unphysiological way that it happens in three times a week disappears the more often you dialyze. You don't need a helper with six times a week or nocturnal dialysis, and the well-being is sky high in nocturnal dialysis. This just shows nursing interventions on dialysis, a multi-center study that we were involved in looking at the difference between conventional three times a week and daily dialysis, and you can see that the nursing interventions markedly went down with daily dialysis. This says what the patient's assessment of dialysis was. When they first went to six times a week dialysis, they said, you know what, why I feel rotten three times a week with dialysis. Why do I want to feel rotten six times a week? And I dread coming to dialysis three times a week. Why do I want to dread it six times a week? You can see that they liked daily dialysis. And we've done studies where we had patients go from three times a week dialysis to daily dialysis to nocturnal. In all the assessments that we've done, they all get markedly better the more frequently they dialyze. And the people who dialyze at night lead normal lifestyles. They are on a normal diet. The only dietary restriction they have is salt. No potassium restriction, no phosphorus restriction, no phosphate binders. I'm going to skip through these. Quality of life, we know with frequent dialysis, improvement in cognitive function, sleep patterns, sense of well-being, level of energy, and appetite, and vocational rehab. Dialysis and diet, we talked a lot about, and I'm rushing here because I think I'm going over, but the diet in dialysis basically is to prevent complications. And the first is salt and fluid overload, so they're on a salt-restricted diet and a fluid-restricted diet to prevent phosphorus retention, so phosphorus-controlled diet, prevent elevations in potassium, so a low-potassium diet, unwanted weight loss. We want to make sure that people don't come cachectic to dialysis. We want to avoid negative calcium balances, so we want to make sure they get enough calcium. And we want to avoid protein malnutrition, which I spoke about. And I mentioned this, that on nocturnal, their diet is basically normal, and they're on a high phosphorus diet. In fact, individuals that were on our initial nocturnal study, we fed them in the hospital after they got off dialysis. They had breakfast, and they went to Dairy Queen for breakfast after that and had ice cream. They had pizza parties because they could eat the foods that they hadn't been able to eat for so long. Because you can't eat pizza. It has tomatoes and cheese. Both of those will get a dialysis patient and a lot of salt. But they would go, in fact, they became unhealthy because they were eating very unhealthy diets that we had to rein them in and say, you know, your lipids are getting out of control here and you're gaining a lot of weight, et cetera. So advantages of frequent dialysis. It is very safe. You also don't have to worry about access trouble. There is no increased problems with dialysis access with frequent dialysis. It can be done at home, does not require a trained helper, which is one of the stumbling blocks to home dialysis, and you get more free time. You get to do it when you want. I have patients who do their daily dialysis at home when they're helping their children with their homework at night, or when they're sitting with their spouse just watching TV after they've worked all day. I'll get to that. It's right now for the government, it's a financial disadvantage. Well, they think it is, but I'll get to that at the end. But we're up there lobbying, just like you all are up there lobbying. And it improves well-being. Now, here are the questions. Will it be cost-effective? Because right now, in 1974, Medicare decided that no family should starve just because a family member needed renal replacement. So Medicare pays for all dialysis, for all individuals on dialysis. They pay for 3 times a week dialysis. In my mind, they pay to minimally keep that patient going. They don't pay to keep them well. We have to justify once a month that they're dialyzing more frequently, and they'll pay for an extra dialysis session a month. I am very privileged. At Mayo, they have and I'm also the associate director of dialysis, that they have allowed me to dialyze people as frequently as we feel fit for the patient, because we know for the system it is a money saver. If it will decrease the cost of caring for a patient, if you decrease their hospitalization by 8%, and we are proving now that this happens, so hopefully we can convince Medicare or CMS. There is a significant decrease in the cost of medications, decreased phosphate binders. On nocturnal, they don't need any. Decreased blood pressure medications, decreased need for erythropoietin, incredibly expensive. There's also improved rehabilitation. These people can go back to the workforce. They can have a well life. And there's also a decreased labor cost if individuals go home. We don't need to employ all these nurses then in dialysis. The individuals can dialyze at home. But the cost is with supplies. We have tried to also lobby with the big dialysis supply companies to try to get them to decrease the cost of supplies so that dialysis units in the community can afford to dialyze people frequently. And they said, well, once Medicare pays for them, then we'll decrease it. So it's sort of back and forth. But that's the only downside. So what are the advances in dialysis? We now understand what adequate dialysis is. We are better at managing the complications of end-stage renal disease that I have listed here. And there's improvement in technology. Here's a typical dialysis machine that you see in dialysis units, hemodialysis machine. It needs a separate water supply. It takes about 45 minutes to set it up and tear it down. Here are new dialysis machines that are much more conducive to dialyzing at home. Doesn't need a separate water supply. Very small. Doesn't need a special electrical outlet. Here is the Access Personal Dialysis Machine. It is made so that the patient or individual can do this at home themselves with a touch screen in their reclining chair as they dialyze. And this little thing here is a shelf that flips up so you can put your needles in when you're right there. There are chips in here, so the doctor knows exactly what you've been doing at home. So it's easily monitored. Here's a picture of a single mother dialyzing at home with one of the more cumbersome machines. with her son. She doesn't have a helper at home. That's the only other person that lives with her. And so this can be done. Now I want to just take 2 seconds to talk about all of our responsibilities before someone gets to dialysis, and that is living a healthy lifestyle. This is a study that looked at 4,000 patients that had early renal disease. And if you look at their other illnesses that they had, 90% had hypertension, 67% with diabetes. And look at this. These are all cardiovascular diseases. We know that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of patients with chronic kidney disease and patients on dialysis. So it is very important to prevent cardiovascular disease before you get to dialysis. Control blood pressure, number one. No matter what the underlying renal disease is, we know if blood pressure is out of control, it will accelerate and progress to end-stage renal disease much more quickly. Treat high lipids, very, very important. Exercise, incredibly important. Avoid obesity. We now know that that adipose tissue around the abdomen isn't just a cosmetic problem and doesn't just cause excess weight. It actually produces vasoactive substances that can accelerate renal disease and accelerate heart disease. So it's very important to avoid obesity. And don't smoke. For heaven's sakes, don't smoke. And so stay healthy. The healthier you are before dialysis, the healthier on dialysis. I'm sorry I went over.
I have just a few closing remarks. We have top-notch speakers. Thank you very much for coming and sharing your knowledge and your time with us.